Welcome to the Human Factors and Ergonomics Hub, a series of educational podcasts that showcase the connection between human capabilities and good work design. Brought to you by the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society of Australia. Today, I'm chatting with Elise Crawford. Elise has a PhD, is a professional ergonomist and safety professional. She's currently a lecturer and researcher at CQ University, leading the practical human factors and ergonomics activities for residential schools for the undergraduate and postgraduate students. This work supports the development of emerging human factors and ergonomics professionals. In this episode, Elise Crawford discusses work and the role of the human factors professional in good work design. What do you think a human factors and ergonomics professional is, and what do we do?
Okay, so first of all, the profession is quite broad. So we cover a number of domain areas, so the physical, the cognitive, organisational and environment. So, but our primary focus is how the human interacts in those areas and in those domains. And so you'll see that there'll be various specialists in this area, depending on their background. And I guess my interest is mainly in cognitive ergonomics because I started my research in human factors related to complex systems and how do these new systems impact the job performance of the operators. And so that's where my area of particular interest is. Having said that, I am a HFE specialist teacher at CQ University, and so I'm often taking the students to residential schools where we do a number of different types of assessments to give them an overview of what to do. So that's my main area now. I do a little bit of consultancy presenting. I know Sharon presents in courts and things. I haven't moved into that, but that's another area. So it's quite a broad field and pretty interesting, I might add.
It's really interesting. So how did you become involved in design? I think you're in or involved in design. So let's maybe talk about that.
Yeah, well, design, I mean, I've been in the arts. So before this new career, which I call in human factors, I used to be a music and drama teacher. So I loved design and all that creative work and everything. But there came a time in my life where I thought, well, I needed to do something more. And I think this happens quite a lot now. It's not the old days where you would stay in one profession forever. So this seems to be speeding up as work change seems to be speeding up as well. But anyway, I've always enjoyed design work. And so when I studied my occupational health and safety degree, that's when I was really introduced to human factors. And I thought, this is my area, you know, get to the crux of things at the design, have a lot of that fun and creativity and that all suited me very well. And I'm still doing that sort of work. So it's great. Well, I then became interested in work design because when I was doing my research, I started tracing the impact of technology, new technology on workers. And in particular, my initial subjects or my not subjects, but my participants in my research were safety critical operators. So they were working with systems that if something went wrong, it would go wrong in a big way. So planes would crash into each other or trains and electrical faults, those sort of big issues that can impact the public as well. And what I learned, and so I started this in about 2010. So in the fourth industrial revolution where things were getting automated, robotics, big data, greater complexities, those sort of things. And what it came down to nearly every time was, well, how am I going to be affected? Meaning, how is the job going to change and how will that impact me? And then at the end of the day, they say, well, and how will that keep my interest? Like, will I still be interested in this work? And so then I realized the design of work is really important, and to design without any consultation of the people who are actually going to do that work means that they will make up their own reasons why the change is coming. You know, oh, they're just trying to get rid of us, or they're trying to outskill me so that they really, you know, can't just sack me. They'll do it this other way and I won't want to. So they'll make up, they'll try to reason why, you know, these new technologies are coming in. But it happens in other organisations too. But we are very technology driven now, even at the university. It's not safety critical, but some of those enterprise systems really test us. So it's not that, you know, and it can become so bureaucratic that you feel like you're just stifled. And so that really has really interested me in trying to find that best solution for our workers, to optimise the work for them and be their advocate. Sometimes I feel like, well, who is the poor old worker's advocate?
So we talk about good work design, and then we also talk about work health and safety initiatives. Let's talk about that, because there's a difference.
That's right. So we've got a number of national initiatives, and one of the biggest one in Australia, of course, is Safe Design. And prior to that, the United States had brought out Prevention Through Design, New Zealand's brought out Safety in Design. Each of those are very similar, and the goal is to keep people safe at work, and to keep them safe using this equipment that's made safely in this environment that's been designed for their safety, and all of that. And that, you know, these initiatives came out only in the 2007. I think that's when Safe Australia, Safe Work Australia, established Safe Design. The US started earlier, but that hasn't been around a lot. Risk management and safety management systems have been developing a lot longer. But I was looking up, when was the first risk assessment? It was 1960. It seems like a long time ago, but we're a young discipline. I say OHS is a young discipline. I say we're a young discipline because I actually am also a safety professional who's morphed into human factors. And so, but having those initiatives is very important because it gives everybody guidance, in particular, especially the smaller businesses that really can't afford to be recreating the wheel, so to speak. So, you know, the initiatives give us that broad overview, principles to follow, and then you can contextualize it according to your organization. So those initiatives from the government are really important. And really, if we want to enact change in industry as researchers, we need to have the policymakers on board, because that gives us leverage. And so they're highly important. But they only go so far, just like Australian standards. So there are design standards set, but they're not what we would call absolute best practice. They are best practice at a certain level of quality to ensure the integrity, the safety, the quality, or whatever is being proposed, so that the small businessman in particular can follow, or small business person rather, can follow those guidelines, and the consumer or the workers, and that can be assured, or the PCBUs can be assured that they've got that certain level of quality. So, I mean, the regulators, I've actually worked with the Queensland regulator. They are not trying to stifle businesses. They're trying to put in a policy in place to protect people and to give them guidance, but not to make it so difficult and expensive that it's too hard for the smaller operators. So there's always that little bit of leeway. But what I've noticed about all of these different prevention through design, safe design approaches is that they cover the basic, our human basic needs. So I often think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. He's a psychologist, and he was a humanist. And we might say that, you know, that's where positive psychology comes from. So people can empower themselves. People have a voice. They're not determined by their genetics. They can get out of their situation and make life better. You know, so he had this very positive outlook. And he developed this hierarchy of needs as five stages, and I think they've been developed on by others. But the basic one, the very bottom one, is physiological. So, you know, clean air, clothing and shelter. But if we think of it as a workplace issue, the people need to have sufficient oxygen to breathe. So that's a concern for confined spaces or contaminants in the air that's going to, you know, expose us to toxins and things. So, yes, that's highly important. We don't want our work to hurt them. Then the next level up is safety. And so this is very much where the OHS world focused. So we've got the basic physiological things taken care of, then the safety, the security, knowing that you're going to go to work today and you'll come home to your family and you'll go again tomorrow. And that's the goal. And that's where a lot of the social uprising was about in the early, when the first industrial revolution came and accidents were happening and they go, what is this? And why is my young boy, because back then children were workers, why is he, you know, there were deaths. And so social uprising helped change policy to where we get this duty of care for our workers. But so that only takes us, though, to those basic needs. And it used to be thought, well, well-being is, you know, a little bit higher than that, or even the self-esteem and the feeling of belonging and all that. And people go, well, why is it our responsibility, you know, as a maybe a business owner to empower or to build up people? You know, we're just wanting, hiring them for a certain job, and we're going to keep them safe. We don't want to hurt them because we, you know, want them, you know, we're not going to do that. But it's taking that next step. And I think it's really important because when they are moving into a fifth industrial revolution, every time there's massive changes to the way we do work. And one professor in the University of Technology in Sydney coined it as the fourth industrial revolution as the humanless revolution because of automation putting people out of jobs, you know, trying to design things to remove the fallible human who's going to make mistakes. Well, machines make mistakes too. They can't perform perfectly. We can't expect them to do it all the time. They need maintenance. And so people need maintenance. We need recovery time. We're just like the assets that we love, our machines and technologies. The human should also be considered an asset. And I know we have resource management and we consider people as resources, but if we thought of them as assets, we might also care for them so that they can keep doing the work that we want them to do. And that's where we start going beyond that line above the basic needs into the next level. And that's where good work design is growing. And we might even ask, I was surprised, there's over 100 years research done in work design. And you think, well, don't we know it? Well, how can we know it? Work is evolving constantly. And so there are calls for better ways to do things so that we can have sustainable work, not just sustainable, but work we want in the future. So this has been the issue with the fourth industrial revolution. And some researchers are saying, it's now time to use that technology for good, to promote people. But in the meantime, the advancement and the loss of jobs has created a very a broad disparity between workers. So people in the larger businesses can ride through this, but the others, you know, fall through. And then, of course, we had COVID hit, a pandemic that totally fastened all of those processes. So technology allowed for globalization, global economies and things. And so those companies that have been international and can handle this adjustment, who were already maybe operating online, can do quite well, and the others suffered. But we've now got a new class of workers that are living in very precarious jobs, and they're called the precariat. So, and they're the ones mainly in developing countries. We don't feel it as much. We've got a little bit more of a social system that can help us, but not everyone's in the same situation globally. And this is a growing body of people. So I feel if we can move beyond just trying to keep safe, because it's the same as risk management. If we're just looking at, well, this is the rules and the legislation and we draw the line in the sand, so we're working at heights and we've got these things in place and we're not going to do any more, we're just going to make sure we're safe, keep an eye on it, then that downward sort of looking, I think we need to look up and go, well, how can we work together and structure things so that it's the benefit for everybody, the business as well as the workers. So the other one of the other differences with good work design that it offers, it brings up us into thinking beyond the bare needs to, well, what is the relationship with workers? Is there trust? If there isn't trust, why isn't there trust? And asking those questions.
Can I just ask a question about the precariat? Is this the gig economy worker? Or is this someone else?
Well, this can be the gig economy worker. So some people choose to be in the gig economy, and these can be very qualified people. So since the pandemic, people have seen there's a lot more options out there, and the internet has allowed us to source experts more easily than the old-fashioned way, advertising in newspapers and things like that. So some of the quite specialist people have decided, oh, well, I'll just do gigs. You know, they might be in their later ages and they don't need to build and buy a house and things like that. They're pretty well set up. And so they will opt to just take consultancy work when they feel like it, things they're interested in. So they're one part of the gig economy. Another part are these Uber drivers and things like that, where there's no set hours. They just nominate their availability. But obviously their availability, they need to earn an income. So, you know, that can be all over the place, or it can be at the worst times when they know they can get constant work and things like that. Those people don't have any job security. There's no guarantee, oh, well, you'll get at least 4 hours work. So that makes planning very difficult. I dare say they wouldn't be able to get a bank loan. And so they become the renter class that really struggles even to know that they can pay next week's rent. And we would have some of those people here in Australia, but it's more pronounced in the developing countries, much more pronounced. But it's a growing concern. This is a rising class. And so is that the way we want work? Like, it's great to have flexibility. I like the flexibility of being able to choose to work from home or work, you know, because I'm set up now. So, you know, the equipment works and everything. In fact, Sharon, I'm going overseas at the end of this month and I've got a whole setup that I can just, very tiny and that's portable, take it with me and I can set up an office, you know, in another country. It makes life a lot easier. But if I didn't know if I came back, I still had a job, you know, then there's no security and it's hard to plan the future. But what we're finding is there's a lot more people now reporting psychosocial or mental health problems. A couple of things the pandemic did for us. One, it allowed for us, helped us realize that there's a lot of things we can do online, greater flexibility. It made people question, actually, well, why am I killing myself at work? That's not acceptable. So now they're not killing themselves, but I shouldn't use that because then we think of accidents and everything. But, you know, they might be extending their days and working really hard and really putting in a big effort. And then they realize at the end of the day, I've sacrificed my family. Now that I'm home with my family, I realize this. And so it helped people realize some of the things they've been doing for work haven't been as fulfilling as maybe they thought they did. Now, some jobs are very rewarding and I really enjoy my job, and sometimes I do overwork because I'm interested in some project. And so my husband suffers and, you know, what about me? And so it is important to get that work-life balance. And I think because we could, for me, it was good to work from home because my children are grown up. For others, it was very chaotic because they had very young children or they were having to homeschool and things like that. But it did give us greater awareness of what we can do with a bit more flexibility. And so there were some good learnings out of that. But then there was also the realization that maybe this isn't what I want to do, and so I want that flexibility. And so this gig economy that we were talking about before has been enlivened with professionals wanting to go a bit more flexible, and also it gave some people an opportunity to get a job that they couldn't normally get. So a lot of the, I think of people who are new to a country, so new immigrants. So Australia has a lot of people who come in under various visas because of labour shortages, and they found it a lot easier to get that sort of work because it wasn't going to be full-time for so many years, which that sort of type of work is seemingly going out of style. But so anyway, but then the other thing that happened was we started to get a lot more people reporting mental health issues in the workplace. And so psychologically there, which we hadn't really gone into in the safety world, focusing on the psychological side of our workers. We've looked at their safety, keep them safe. And even then, you know, we have some, they're not always perfect, but that is where our, you know, in focus was. In human factors, we're focused on the whole human. So we're not limited to just the safety or the basic needs. We're happy to look at those psychosocial needs. And it was interesting because we've now got a new code of practice on psychosocial hazards, which has extended into the design of work. It used to be, we used to think of it as harassment and discrimination and things like that. Now we're looking at, well, do you have autonomy? Do you have flexibility at work? So we're now looking at work design things. So that is a good thing. What was good, though, and an outcome of this reporting of mental health was that people were happier to report it. And I'm hoping that stigma. So mental health is a physical condition. It's to do with your brain. It's not some weird, you know, thing that people aren't really sure about. It's a physical thing, and we get fatigued mentally as well as physically. So, you know, to be able to say, I need a mental health day, I'm exhausted, or I've got these issues. I think that has been a good move because there still is stigma. There still isn't maybe enough education about it. And all of this has brought this to the forefront. And so I think that's a good thing in general for the community and society.
So how can the human factors professional work to improve this? Because you've talked about physical work design, and then you've moved into psychological risks in the workplace and cognitive work design and organisational work design you're talking about as well. So where does the human factors professional fit, and what can they do?
Yeah, so to me, the human factors professional is a perfect advocate for the human. So we are interested in the human and how they interact with work and the environment and with tools and technology. And so there's a lot of specialty areas, but we are concerned about the human. And I think if all workplaces had a human factors expert in there, I think the worker would feel they're well supported. It's different to unions that are kind of adversarial to the business. It's different to health and safety advisors in the organisation who really are advisors to the management. And while they help workers, at the end of the day, they still are there for the managers. Whereas a human factors professional can be one of those people who come in for getting work nice for workers, as well as so they can work with strategic planning and at that higher level within the organisation, and they can try to bring in those objectives into work. And so, and caring then for the worker. So the interaction for the worker, is this good for all workers? We're all different. So you can't just say, oh, here's a neat package. Here's what you do with your workers, because that won't work, because everybody is different. And as I said earlier, I changed my title career, which back for my generation, that was a big deal. And because I reached another point in my life where I needed to do something different and to learn more things. So you'll find some workers are willing to participate in the design of their job, and this is where good work design is trying to go. We're trying to empower our workers so that they understand what design is, how you design, their involvement, where their expertise is, where they can contribute to the design. It's not like you say, okay, now you're going to design your work and leave them to their own devices. So that human factors professional can help corral, can help facilitate, can help draw out that expertise that's often hidden inside the person. So it's hard to articulate if you say, well, what's your expertise, or how do you do this job? And they may not think of it in a procedural manner anymore, because it's become part of them, you know. So to try to glean that out, that is the, I think, the really good position that human factors professionals can have, the really good not position, but the how they can contribute. Yeah. So because the profession is driven by design, it's focused on the human, and we also, as a profession, have developed a whole pile of methods and tools for helping us do that. And, you know, many of these tools overlap into other disciplines and things like that, but we can bring that. And we're also part of a society that can back us up and give us more information in areas that we don't know, or we can draw on other experts in those different areas, depending on what's happening in the work and type of work that's there.
You've talked about automation, and you and I both know that humans are programming the automation. So automation doesn't remove the human at all, does it?
No. So automation, okay, you can't remove all the users, okay, all the people. And so there's the designers. They are in there designing the automation. And then the automation's doing its job. And, yes, a lot of people will be out of a job. But then there are the maintenance people. So no machine can just be made and be expected to work hard without needing maintenance or without needing parts changed and things like that. And this is one of the complaints maintenance people have. They say they put this equipment in situ and I can't maintain it because there's a wall there. They didn't think that I'd need to get behind it, or, you know, so think little things like that. So there are always people who need to, and then you need people to monitor automation. Is it doing what it's supposed to do? Now, how can we do that if we're not being fed information and that feedback on what the system's at and where's it at? So otherwise, a terrible thing will happen, and that's how you find out it's not doing the right thing. This is a little bit where machine learning now is making people a little bit nervous as well, because the machine will pick up what common things are happening, and it can be very useful. So, for instance, in a safety critical situation, if you get a lot of, say, electrical trips in a certain area, and another one happens, immediately they can get the screens to come up on that trip, because the machine has learned, oh, chances are it's this guy because we've had so many trips, you know. And so it can help fast track. But it's knowing, well, what is the machine going to do in a certain situation? And that's what makes people nervous. That situational awareness needs to be in that interface. That needs to be designed in that interface. So that's another area where human factors experts are really good at helping get that interface where the human who's interacting with it can get good situational awareness. So in the past, it's been like a black box effect often. And so, of course, when things go wrong, no one's aware of it. And then who's to blame? The person monitoring the system, but they can't see what's going on. So you get into these situations that aren't ideal. there are times when automation is really good. Obviously we need people to conceive and design, and then those who create the automated or the robotics, and then the maintainers and then the monitors. But sometimes it's useful, especially for musculoskeletal disorders that can develop from certain tasks, to be able to automate that, have a machine do it, is very good. And I'm thinking of robotics now. To have a machine create medical equipment that is to the nth degree in perfect shape and size and works a certain way, is really good. But what machines tend to do is they learn from actions that are happening by users or things that are happening outside that are being responded to, but they can't think creatively outside the box. They're basing, the machine is learning based on what it's learned, not on what is a possibility into the future. And that is the thing that humans can do. We can, you know, we've got all this sci-fi stuff, and eventually it becomes reality because somebody thought of it out of the blue, and it was, you know, up in blue sky sort of stuff. And, you know, we've been able to do it. So, but then it comes to the point where you go, well, ethically, especially if it involves, you know, removing people from the workplace ethically, or even if we look in the future, is this the type of work we want? And I think we need to think about that. So technology, I went to a conference one time, and the technology guys are just go, 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 because if they don't invent it now, someone else will. It's going that fast. And so who's slowing them down? Who's asking the questions? Hey, is this an ethical issue? Do we mind if bots are talking to us on the phone when we are booking an appointment or something, you know, asking for our private details? There's hardly any time to ask those questions, or those questions aren't being asked because technology is really moving along fast. And because otherwise those guys won't get paid, or they won't have they won't win jobs and or win grants to create these things. So they work very fast. And so for us human factors people are looking at the human interaction, sometimes that's always delayed because the advancements in technology are that fast. It's a little bit scary, but I think it's important for everyone to stop and say, what kind of work do we want in the future? You know, we want sustainable work, but is it the type of work? It's like those controllers who were so bored and they felt they were losing their skills because all they did was monitor. Nothing ever went wrong in their watch, and it was not for them anymore. So is it the type of work we want? I think that function allocation, it still needs to be meaningful for those workers. Otherwise, either they're locked out or they just become disgruntled. They know it's not fulfilling, and they'll change their career like me. You know, you get to a certain point where you go, you know, I need something new and fresh. So that's the risk.
In our next episode, Elise will discuss human factors and ergonomics tools for work analysis and usability. Thanks for joining us at the Human Factors and Ergonomics Hub, brought to you by the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society of Australia, where human-centred design really matters. If you like this podcast, make us your favourite in your podcast app. We look forward to chatting with you next time.